Well, and now politics, national politics, Kansas politics, and even the Missouri variety. So much is going on, and that makes it a very good time to kick around the big races and what it all means. We'll start with the huge developments this week in the race for the White House. With us, Dave Helling of the Kansas City Star. David, good morning.
Good morning.
Patrick Miller is an assistant professor of political science over at the University of Kansas. And Patrick, nice to have you, too.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
You know, a lot of people are wondering, as this race comes to an end, the GOP primary race, for president, about whether Donald Trump can actually win the general election race in November. David, can he?
Yes, he can. Will he? A much, much longer shot. Mm-hmm. I'm writing a weekend story about the consensus, the rough consensus among most political scientists and analysts that presidential choices are really locking in right about now. It isn't as if we don't know who Donald Trump is or what he stands for. There's some wiggle room, but not a lot. And, of course, Hillary Clinton has been around for a quarter century. They are the most unpopular people to ever be nominated in the modern era for president of the United States. And so the question is whether those attitudes can be dislodged, and if so, how, between now and Election Day, again, assuming that Hillary Clinton is the nominee, which I think most people do. So I think the consensus is it's going to be a brutal campaign, a negative campaign. Analysts were saying it's going to be a race to the bottom because it's harder to build your own negatives than to add to the negatives of your opponent. Whether that makes much of a difference or not, we'll have to see.
Patrick Miller, do you see a path to the White House for Donald Trump, a realistic path forward?
Realistically, I don't know if he can pull it off, but the strategy is obviously one of trying to tear down Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. You know, he has incredibly high negatives. I think one thing to realize about Clinton is that a lot of the comparisons we're seeing right now in the national press are a little bit apples to oranges. Her negatives are not necessarily that much higher than a lot of presidential candidates when they get well known at the end of campaigns. It just, she's been around, she's a known quantity, she's partisan polarizing like a lot of candidates are. But the thing about her favorables over time is they're very variable. I mean, one thing she said that is right, people like her when she's not running for office. Mm-hmm. So she needs to try to tap into the positive things that people think about her, even though the negative is primed right now. Trump's strategy is to prime that negative and make people kind of forget that they don't like him.
You know, Dave, you just did a piece the other day that pointed out that while some Republicans from Missouri and Kansas are behind Donald Trump, some are not. Tell us about that.
Well, correct. The people who are behind him, Steve, are lukewarm at best. I mean, Roy Blunt has said, well, he's the nominee. Kevin Yoder on the Kansas side, well, he's the nominee. We've heard from Chris Kobach. Kobach, of course, was an early Trump endorser and is probably the most enthusiastic elected official in the Trump camp in either state. Sam Brownback's coming aboard a little bit in Kansas. But by and large, I think that Republicans in our neck of the woods are approaching the Trump candidacy much like the National Republican Party, which is a grudging acceptance, a bit of a warming, but a lot of wait and see still. And, you know, one of the things—
Which is not a good sign.
Well, but keep this in mind. Donald Trump is by far the most unique candidate that you or I have ever covered for president. Mm-hmm. And so many of the rules we think apply may not apply now. They may. It may be that in November, all the things that we think we know about presidential politics will come to pass, and he'll lose by 12 points, and Hillary Clinton will take the oath. And I still think that's the most likely thing that will happen. But you know, we've misjudged Trump's appeal. We've misjudged his tactics. His polling numbers did go from 1% the day he announced to winning the nomination. So he has some sense of what he needs to do. Primaries are very different from general elections. We know that. And so, again, I think some of the old rules we believe will lock back into place. But everyone I talked to this week said, you know, be careful, because we don't really understand all of the things we should about Donald Trump, and he could upset the apple cart.
You know, Patrick Miller, again, from KU, explain something to me here, why Governor Brownback, why Senator Pat Roberts would be on board with Donald Trump, but Jerry Moran, the second U.S. senator from Kansas, who's on the ballot this year, isn't willing to come forward and endorse Trump yet. What's going on there? What explains why one senator would be on board and the other one would not?
Well, I mean, every politician has their own unique motivations. Moran obviously is running for re-election. He'll very likely get re-elected, but incumbents always have to worry about watching their own back a little bit. And he doesn't want too much negativity to be out there in case Trump goes south. And I think that's why a lot of Republican incumbents now are kind of vaguely saying, well, I support the nominee, but they won't quite say Trump. Mm-hmm. They're hedging their bets to see how this goes. I think a lot of the what we're starting to see is the wagon circling a little bit. I agree that right now, if the election were held, Hillary Clinton would easily win. I think what's on the minds of a lot of Republicans is minimizing the down ballot damage at this point in the Senate and the House. And they're in a very precarious position because right now Republicans are defending a lot of weak incumbents running in some blue territory from two big waves, 2010, 2014.
Mm-hmm.
If I had to put my money on it, I'd say they lose the Senate. If Democrats win the presidency, they need four Senate seats for a majority. They've got two pretty much in the bag, which means they have to take two from a wealth of other toss-ups. Republicans are not polling well right now. They have, they've gerrymandered themselves a nicely protected House majority, and Republicans will likely keep that, but they need to minimize the damage there. And so right now, a lot of getting the party to come together is about keeping Republicans enthusiastic for preserving as many down-ballot incumbents as possible.
Which is why the question, Steve, isn't really why Jerry Moran would or would not endorse Donald Trump, but rather how Democrats will use the Trump candidacy against vulnerable Republicans.
And you see them already using it very aggressively across the country.
Yes, in Arkansas, for example, they're running Donald Trump quotes against the Republican incumbent who's on the ballot. We'll see how this strategy plays out in our own backyard with Jason Kander, the Democrat in Missouri, who will run against Roy Blunt. Everyone thought a year ago that Blunt was a pretty safe bet for re-election. But polling and other information suggests that's a much closer race than we expected even 6 months ago. And to the extent that Donald Trump hurts the Republican brand in Missouri, which I think most analysts think it does to some degree, it could splash back on Roy Blunt. And he's got a very difficult decision to make. I mean, does he appear on the stage with Donald Trump? Does he keep him at arm's length?
There's some news today that he's already endorsed Donald Trump.
Well, he's not really endorsed him. What he said is, I will support the nominee of the Republican Party, which is the formulation a lot of Republicans are using, which is, somebody, I think Kelly Ayotte said, well, I support him, but I don't endorse him. So, mm-hmm. They're all in a pickle. Mm-hmm. They're all facing a difficult choice. The last poll I saw showed Hillary Clinton beating Donald Trump in Missouri. Now, Missouri is a plus 10 red state for the Republican nominee for president in a normal year. If Clinton is even marginally ahead in current polling, that suggests Trump is not as popular in the state as another Republican would be. And Roy Blunt will have to figure out how to navigate those choppy waters if he mm-hmm. wants to win re-election. And the Democrats will have to find out how much of an issue they want to make Donald Trump in the fall campaign.
Well, gentlemen, let me interrupt this conversation. We're talking about the national race for president to bring in Janet Merguia, who has deep Kansas City, Kansas roots. She's president and CEO of the National Council of La Raza. And we're going to talk to Janet about the latest controversy involving Donald Trump. It's the Taco Bowl controversy. Donald Trump yesterday tweeted a picture of himself eating a Taco Bowl, including the phrase, "I love Hispanics," I guess, beneath that photo. Janet Merguia, welcome. And what was Donald Trump thinking?
Well, it's really hard to know and pretty astonishing. And in my own view, I thought, he hit the Trump trifecta. It was reflected that he was clueless, offensive, and self-promoting. It felt like we were going back to the day when politicians thought that all they had to do was eat a taco or wear a sombrero to win the Latino vote. Obviously, this is 2016, and those days are long gone. But we've kind of come to learn not to be surprised by anything or any of his tactics.
How much support, broadly speaking, from your perch there as the president and CEO of the National Council of La Raza, Janet, how much support does Donald Trump have among Hispanics across this country right now?
Well, you don't have to take my word for it. There's most recent poll, I think, is a CBS News poll,
right,
that was done just recently in the last few weeks. And it's pretty clear that over 80% of Hispanic registered voters view Donald Trump unfavorably. Those are epic and historic high unfavorables for virtually any candidate in recent history. So he's got a daunting challenge, and I know maybe he thought eating a taco bowl might begin this pivot to embrace the Hispanic community, but I think it's going to take a lot more than that.
Janet, I'm wondering, when you saw the photograph that Donald Trump tweeted of himself eating out of the taco bowl, what was your just instinctual first reaction to what you saw?
Well, the truth is, Steve, you don't know whether to laugh or to cry. I mean, really, you don't know whether, you know, so many people have taken, not us and not me, certainly, when he announced his candidacy as a joke. But, you know, here he is now, the presumptive nominee, and you think you want to laugh at a picture like that because it seems so insensitive, so offensive, and pandering. But from day one, I've taken this very seriously. And on the one hand, you know, if you look at it and you think it's funny, you think, in my own mind, I thought, you know, I don't even know what a taco bowl is. There's no self-respecting Latino who would even acknowledge that a taco bowl is part of our culture. So on the one hand, you want to laugh. But on the other hand, you want to think, how can this guy who is, you know, smiling, eating a taco bowl, saying, tweeting, I love Hispanics, send that out when virtually 24 hours earlier, maybe less, he's confirming what he has proposed as it relates to issues that affect many Hispanics in this country and Latinos in this country, and that is mass deportation, building a wall, and ending birthright citizenship,
yeah,
ending the status that these young dreamers have today as protected, would ship all them back. I mean, it's very, it's confounding, but again, we take it very seriously. It appears to be a joke, and people want to be snarky about it, but we're taking this very seriously.
Janet Bergia, always appreciate you taking some time. She's the president and CEO of the National Council of La Raza. Thanks very much.
Sure, Steve. Anytime.
Dave Helling, let me come right back to you here. You just heard Janet Bergia say that 3 out of every 4 Latinos in this country can't support Donald Trump. The taco bowl thing's only going to reinforce some of that. He's disliked by, 62-65% of female voters in this country. That begins to complicate the math very, very quickly for somebody like Donald Trump.
Well, and the electoral math is complicated for any Republican to begin with. I mean, any Democrat starts presidentially with a substantial lead in the electoral college just because of demographics and geography. So even in the
big states like New York, California, pretty much already in the Democratic
column.
Right.
So any Republican would have a bit of a mountain to climb, and Donald Trump's is much higher. Now, a couple of things. First, we should point out Janet Bergia is a pretty well-known Clinton supporter, so
sure,
we'll just point that out. But second, notice how we've talked about Donald Trump and taco bowls, Donald Trump and Paul Ryan, Donald Trump and this appearance, this tweet, that statement. He has been brilliant about dominating the news cycle, where his views, his conversation, his efforts are front and center in the daily political conversation. Hillary Clinton's campaign is going to have to figure out how to cut through that a little bit without, in essence, going down into the mud with him and making this a slugfest, because I don't think, as Marco Rubio proved, you get into a slugfest on minutia with Donald Trump and you'll lose almost every time.
Well, either or Hillary Clinton should take a 4-month vacation in France and let Donald Trump dig himself into an even deeper hole.
Right, and that there is some validity to that strategy because, again, the demographics are on her side. History is on her side. There have been 14 presidential elections since 1960. Of those, the leader, May 1st, in the polls, has won in November 11 of the 14 times.
Mm-hmm.
So history overwhelmingly tells us that presidential choices lock in pretty early and don't really change. They may be a bit volatile around the conventions or the VP pick or whatever, but by and large, most people have made up their minds about Trump and Clinton no matter what is said.
So she
might want to stay. You're right. She might want to just get on a slow boat and check in on November 3rd.
Given that, Patrick Miller, if you're managing Hillary Clinton's campaign, do you tell her to go to France for a few months?
No, decapitate him now. That's I mean, that's the strategy. I mean,
meaning what?
Swing voters don't like Trump. A lot of Republicans don't like Trump. Independents don't like Trump. Her strategy now is to attack and reinforce that negativity, deflect any conversation from her, and make this a referendum on him. And she does that by starting early, staying on message, and not letting up that he is unfit for the White House from her point of view. So the less that she gets in the media, I think the worse for her, because she needs to highlight that negativity. You know, with Trump, I mean, to paraphrase one of my favorite reality stars, if they're not talking about you, you might as well be dead. And mm-hmm. I think that Trump thinks like a reality star, that no matter what you say, make it entertaining and dominate social media and the press. And that's exactly what this Taco Bell strategy is doing. I don't think it's about trying to court Latino voters at all. You know, I will say on that as interesting as Latino voters are, you know, even if you give Clinton 90% of their vote, and let's say you increase their turnout 10% and nothing else changes. The only state it flips is North Carolina. A little bit higher turnout, we start talking about Arizona. They matter at the margins in a lot of states, but a small movement among whites based on, say, college education divisions offsets all of that. So one, the group that I'm particularly interested in looking at is white swing voters divided by college education, no education, because where Trump is polling a lot worse nationally right now as compared to most typical Republicans is among wealthier, higher education female voters in the suburbs, so Johnson County.
You're suggesting the Taco Bell thing, then, Patrick, is intentional on Donald Trump's
part
to drive up support among whites.
No, I mean, I don't think it's necessarily to drive up support about whites at this point. Mm-hmm. I think it's a strategy to have the conversation be about him and his style and not people critiquing him necessarily for
politics. The other thing to keep in mind is, because I think that analysis is exactly right in this sense, the polling numbers, assuming that Donald Trump sticks around, will narrow. I mean, it's almost impossible to see Hillary Clinton, given her own negatives, by the way, that she'll maintain a double-digit lead. You know, mm-hmm. she was 13 points in the NBC Wall Street Journal poll. That's going to tighten. And if Donald Trump is seen, and I think this is the threshold question, in the suburbs primarily, can people see him as a potential president? Right now, the vast majority of Americans cannot. They literally look at him and say, this guy could not be in the White House. But if that begins to shift a little bit and the numbers tighten in August and September, then I think volatility will become an issue. And whatever narrow path Trump may have, he'll understand it and try to drive it as best he can. We'll see what happens.
Let me do this and do a public radio pivot now as we take our political pundits into the world of Kansas politics over in Topeka. The session over there just recently concluded. Joining Dave Helling, Patrick Miller now is Brian Lowry of the Wichita Eagle. Brian, always nice to have you. Good morning. You there, Brian?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, there you
Steve,
are.
Steve, can you hear me?
Yeah, there you are. There you are.
They've got me on two phones just in case anything screwed up.
It happens.
Like something
yeah.
already did. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're coming in loud and clear. As you look back, Brian, on this relatively short session of the legislature, what stood out? I mean, what's the takeaway from what happened in 2016 when it comes to the Kansas legislature?
Well, the takeaway is they just stuck it all on Brownback.
Mm-hmm.
Get through their budget problems by simply sticking it on the governor.
Mm-hmm. He has to cut, $200 million out of that budget, Patrick? Is that what we're talking about here?
The exact figure, yeah. I mean, between this year and next year is in the hundreds of millions, I believe. But yeah, they absolutely stuck it on him, whether they wanted to not take responsibility themselves, whether Republicans in the legislature couldn't agree amongst themselves, or they're just mad at Brian. I mean, Susan Wagle is basically saying, I think she said to Brian Lowry maybe, that there was no leadership coming out of the governor's mansion. I mean, they shoved it on him and went back to their own re-elections, essentially.
Which I wrote in my column today was saying was the ultimate in passing the buck. You know, talk about a political scaredy cat play here. They basically said, well, recognize that Governor Brownback is not on the ballot this year. The lawmakers are. His polling numbers are awful. Give him the tough work of having to cut the budget while lawmakers skate free. Don't do their jobs and skate on to what they hope is a re-election victories here coming up down the road.
I think that's fairly accurate. I mean, if you look at the races right now, I mean, look at the primaries. I think look at the recruits who are coming in the races. Moderate Republicans are clearly on the offense for August. Whether they can pull that off, you know, I think it depends on what kind of Republican shows up. But I think there's a lot of negativity among Republicans against the governor. Democrats have a lot of good recruits, too, although they have a lot of seats that are still left on the table with no candidates. But they're looking at those districts in Kansas that were, you know, maybe 5 to 10 point Romney districts, but where Paul Davis won by, you know, a small margin to maybe 10 points. So they're trying to play in the Romney Davis districts where Democrats are really only going to win by going quite negative on Brownback and tying him to the incumbent.
You know, Brian Lowry, how much regret is there among these Kansas lawmakers over those 2012 tax cuts and whether they simply cut too much? What's your sense?
We have a couple different factions on that. There is one faction that has no regrets whatsoever, but there are a lot of people who have buyer's remorse. Some people may have seen, actually, that the Senate Vice President, Jeff King, put out a statement yesterday saying that he wasn't running for reelection.
I
and specifically that. Actually said that supporting those 2012 tax cuts was an error. And King was among the group that was trying to roll back that exemption this legislative session, and he actually he lamented the fact that they were unable to do that and accused a lot of his colleagues of political cowardice.
I was going to say, Brian, they had a chance to roll back a portion of those cuts. Again, I wrote about that in my column today, and moderate Republicans and many Democrats said, we're not going there. Why?
It was interesting. You had 14 Democrats vote for the bill, and you had 12 vote against it, including the minority leader. And then you really had large swaths of moderate Republicans vote against it. The reason was twofold. And I'll give you – let's give you the idealistic reason and the cynical reason.
Okay.
The idealistic reason is they said this doesn't really fix the problem. We need a bill that goes further. You know, we need a real solution. This is – we need to look at the entirety of the 2012 tax cuts, and, you know, just kind of filling in this part of it isn't really going to solve anything. And then the cynical reason was it's the election. The moderates in particular are worried about getting a postcard in the mail about how they raised your taxes. Barbara Boyer, who's a Republican from Johnson County, actually said that to me after the vote. She saw it as a gotcha vote. And so there were many moderates who they weren't going to risk any skin in the game, especially if they didn't think that the Senate would pass the bill and the governor would sign it.
Can I just throw in here very quickly? I think another element in this is that moderates and Democrats don't want to let Sam Brownback off the hook. They want him to own these tax cuts completely, and anything that even partially ameliorates their impact, I think they're disinclined to support. But I think the biggest lesson from the Kansas legislature this year, and for that matter, Missouri as well, is lawmakers continue to vote strategically and politically and not on the merits.
Hmm.
Not on the merits. Is it good for me? Bad for me? Will I get a postcard? Will I have an ad? Can I run an ad? That disease infects politicians at every level of government. State legislatures particularly, certainly the national government, where votes are cast repeatedly, not because they change anything, but because they'll end up in an ad or on a postcard.
Patrick, are you seeing that too?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I think if you look at on the LLC vote that we're talking about, the loophole vote, most Republicans who are facing moderate primary challengers, they voted to not close the loophole. And I think they're betting on keeping that conservative base enthusiastic and hoping that that turns out.
Yeah.
I think you saw more of that. I mean, if I look at like the what I think are the most vulnerable Republicans in the Romney-Davis districts, most of them voted to keep the tax cuts. You had a couple like, say, James Todd in Overland Park who, you know, has pretty consistently supported Brownback and his economic policies, but then voted for the repeal.
Right.
In his reelection announcement, he touted that as trying to close the loophole. And I think for some legislators, you know, he's an example of that. That's a vote where you can go to the electorate and try to, you know, say to them, oh, look, I'm standing up to Sam Brownback, when really your record is you're pretty consistently supporting him. So every legislator is going to spin this differently.
You know, there was also lots of talks, Brian, this session about the law enforcement community was suffering because of a lack of funds. State hospitals were hurting. They were underfunded. Were those issues addressed?
To some extent, yes. There was a bill – sent to the governor that is going to actually increase the car registration fee for everyone, and that's going to be used for a fund to help hire more highway patrol officers and help retain more officers. And you did have some extra funding put for the state hospitals into that budget bill that passed. Of course, that budget bill has an asterisk because it doesn't balance.
Yeah.
So they were addressed to some extent. I don't think they were addressed to the satisfaction of, you know, some of the people who really cared about those issues, but they weren't completely ignored either.
Well, I want to thank Brian Lowry, as always, for joining the show. Brian Lowry from the Wichita Eagle. Brian, always appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
And Patrick Miller from the University of Kansas. Patrick, always appreciate your comments as well.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, let's take a walk over here on the Missouri side of the state line. That legislative session is still underway. Joining us now is St. Louis Public Radio State House reporter Marshall Griffin. And Marshall, good morning to you.
Good morning. Good to talk to you.
Marshall, give us a quick summary here. Take off the two or three big developments out of Jefferson City this session.
Oh, boy. The two or three biggest developments. Well, I can tell you that SJR 39's failure, actually, you know, something that did not pass was probably the biggest headline so far this session. For those of you unfamiliar with that, this would be Missouri's version of anti-LGBT laws passed in North Carolina and Mississippi. Basically, this was one that was a little bit more narrowly tailored. It would specifically would have shielded clergy and business owners who cited religious objections to same-sex weddings and therefore said, I'm sorry, we will not make your wedding
right.
cake or not, for those reasons. It was the subject of a three-day-long filibuster in the Senate that resulted in the senators, Republican senators, using their version of a nuclear option to get it passed, and then it died in a House committee on a tied vote. So a lot of high drama around that particular issue, and a lot of
anything else catch your attention that this legislative session will be known for?
At this point, the lack of solving Missouri's transportation problem. Now we still have a week to go. It still could happen. But there's a proposal to raise Missouri's fuel tax to help pay for roads and bridges. It got out of the Senate. It's still in the House, and there's the House Republican leaders oppose tax hikes of any type, regardless of what it would go for. And this particular tax hike would only be used for transportation needs and issues. So that remains to be seen what's going to happen on that one. Other than that, as far as the state budget, which will be signed into law today, there's a controversial move to exclude any use of Medicaid dollars to go to Planned Parenthood,
mm-hmm.
Specifically written into the budget to make sure that Planned Parenthood does not get one penny of Medicaid funding in Missouri.
You know, the other issue you hear a little bit about is this voter ID legislation just passed the legislature this week. Very divisive within the General Assembly. Again, it's passed the legislature, but is it going to become law, Marshall?
Well, here's the thing. It's only halfway passed. There's actually two bills. The one that's been sent to Governor Nixon would be the actual implementing bill, but ends on a proposed constitutional amendment, which still is in the Senate and still needs to be sent over to the House. Now, if the constitutional amendment makes it out before next Friday, it would then go before voters. And what that would do, it would allow for the existence of a photo ID law. However, the implementing bill is in the hands of Governor Nixon. He is expected to veto it. But if the proposed constitutional amendment does make it out and does get approved in November, then lawmakers can just come back next year and pass another implementing bill. And they hope with a Republican governor in place. But that's at this point, that's still up in the air.
Dave Helling from The Star also still with me here. What happened to ethics reform, David? I mean, here this was, speaking of issues, things that were going to happen this session, it was touted as the single biggest deal going into January when these lawmakers convened. And yet we sit here today, just days before the session comes to an end, without a whole lot happening.
Right, and nothing was probably more predictable than A, everyone would talk about ethics reform, and B, everyone would do nothing about
and
ethics reform.
And it's so tough to pass. pass, you know, good government measures because why?
Because voters don't really judge their elected leadership by whether they voted for or against ethics reform. Now, if you do something unethical, they'll punish you dramatically. You know, either you quit or you get voted out. But few lawmakers ever go back to the district and say, you know what, I limited campaign contributions, vote for me. That just doesn't really resonate with a lot of voters at election time. And lawmakers who don't vote for that kind of thing aren't punished by the voters. Until that starts happening, it'll be all talk, all hat and no cattle down in Jefferson City and Topeka as well.
And Marshall, are you surprised by the failure of that thing to not to get any farther?
Well, actually, it all depends on how you look at it. You might, the passage and the signing into law of one ethics reform might be actually considered a big success in Missouri, the fact that one actually did make it across the finish line. And there are some other ethics proposals that are still pending, could still make it. But the one that that most observers consider to be the big one, campaign finance limits, that's not going to happen this year.
And no, Marshall,
it happened next year as well because go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask you about concealed weapons. That's gotten some attention as well. A measure passed by the House yesterday allows for concealed carry on public transit. It authorizes full-time employees of public universities to carry guns on campus and prohibits states or federal government from monitoring a concealed carry licensing database. What's the chance of this measure moving forward to the Senate and the governor's signature eventually here?
Very slim. For starters, the Democrats, so there are only 8 Democrats in the Missouri Senate, but they have stood up and filibustered numerous things this session and have shown a willingness to dig in. Now, that said, if the Republican leaders want it bad enough, they can use the nuclear option again, kill the vote and, you know, kill the filibuster and force a vote to take place. Now, the governor would most likely veto this bill, but the key is, will there be enough Republican votes in the House and Senate to override the governor's veto on this issue? Could be a close one.
And Marshall, it seems like the governor's getting overridden every 22 seconds down there right now. Am I right?
Yes, and a lot of that is because there are veto-proof majorities in both chambers, especially in the House. They need 109 votes to veto something, and I believe there's at current count about 116, 117 Republicans in the Missouri House. Now, some of those Republicans are in the middle of the pack and not so much to the right on some issues. So there's no guarantee that that everything they want to get overridden will happen. But they have been able to override Governor Nixon a lot, actually throughout his whole second term, but especially the last two years and this one as well.
David, I got to ask you an impossible question here in 20 seconds. Governor Nixon phasing out now. This is his final session, final legislature term of his career. What do you make of his standing as Missouri's governor, his reputation going out? How will he be
remembered? I think he'll be remembered as a fairly solid governor, particularly on budget issues, spending, and he had a Republican legislature, so that was a problem. But I think he will be remembered on the upside for Joplin and the downside for Ferguson. Mm-hmm. I think his response in both of those tragedies, if you will mark how we look at Jay Nixon, and one is good and one was not good at all.
Marshall Griffin, always appreciate you taking some time. Thanks very much. That's St. Louis Public Radio State House reporter Marshall Griffin. Dave Helling from The Star. Always appreciate it, David.